Last week, we called to your attention the peculiar circumstances which contributed to the rise of Neoplatonism in North Africa, Athens, and Rome. To very briefly summarize this situation, in order that we may use it as a further springboard, we must remember that this sect came into existence almost at the very time the decline and decay of three great empires. We are inclined to think of these changes as affecting only political units. But as H.G. Wells so well pointed out, there is no great political change that does not profoundly affect the status of the individual. And although we do not always have an adequate account of the reaction upon private citizens, this reaction must be regarded as profound. And so we have a great school of philosophy, essentially mystical, rising out of the ashes of the three great empires. And as has always been observed in the descent of human institutions, there is an inevitable revulsion away from materialism whenever we have a marked decline in political conditions. As uncertainties increase, wars multiply, private problems mount, the individual turns inevitably to the consolation of his spiritual convictions. And as many historians and the literature of the time points out, the decline of these empires did not mean the total extinction of idealists. It did not mean that all Romans were corrupt, all Grecians decadent, or all Egyptians reactionaries. These large generalities cannot safely be applied to any group of human beings because each individual has a nature of his own and may be an exception to any rule by which we seek to capture or define him. We have ample evidence at this time, for example, of the rise of a group of powerful idealistic institutions representing a desperate effort on the part of human beings themselves to meet the emergency in which they found themselves. And, of course, prominent among these groups were those in Syria and the Lebanon, the Essenes, the Johnanites, the Therapeutae, and the groups of the Semitic schools and colonies in Egypt under the leadership of men like Philo Judaeus. We also have the tremendous rise of Gnosticism in Syria under Simon Magus and in Egypt under Basilides. We find the rise of a great restoration of learning in Greece under the ample leadership of Proclus, who has been called the Platonic successor. And in Rome, Plotinus, probably one of the most outstanding men of his time. I've told you many things about Plotinus, and I think perhaps you all know the story which perhaps best typifies his life. He lived in a decadent period of Roman history. He lived as a tutor and teacher of children. And whatever we may think of the Romans in those days of the debauched Caesars, we must recognize that they also seem to have realized the importance of honest men. For many Roman families left their entire estates under the trusteeship of Plotinus. At one time, he is said to have held most of the wealth of the patrician class of Rome in his own hands, not for his own use, but because he was the executor of estates. Also, in those days when men's lives were uncertain, many approached him and asked him to accept the guardianship of their children if any evil befell them, and it often befell. And during the closing years of his life, it is said that Plotinus lived in the atmosphere of a kindergarten, that there were dozens of young people, hundreds in fact, under his care, that he worked with each one of them, that he assisted the young women to proper marriages and homes, that he established the young men in business, and that through his busy life of philosophy, he was never for a moment hesitant in turning his attentions to the needs of a nursing infant. And yet this man has survived to us as probably one of the most stupendous intellects of his time, yet known in his own day as one of the kindliest and most simple persons who ever lived. So in even these discordant and difficult periods, there was much true greatness, and much of it centered in the great rise of Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism, let us remember, was separated from the historical school of Plato by over 400 years. It also was deeply concerned with the Pythagorean problems, from which it was separated by better than 600 years. Thus, Neoplatonism cannot be said to be merely Platonism restated. Neoplatonism was an interpretation, based certainly upon Platonic principles, but adapted to the needs of a different type of world from the one that Plato ever knew. A world which had a great deal of sadness in it. A world despondent with the weight of its own worldliness. A disillusioned, almost neurotic world. A world that had lost its securities. A world in which the private citizen was no longer able to count his blessings or to determine with reasonable certainty his own daily future. Thus, in these times, the great descent of the Platonic tradition served as a powerful instrument, as has been pointed out by many historians, in preserving a certain measure of calmness, a certain measure of detached thoughtfulness toward life, which might otherwise have almost totally ceased in the pandemonium which finally ended in the great invasions by the Goths, the Visigoths, and the tremendous and powerful campaigns of Attila. So Neoplatonism was more than just a philosophy. It was the heart and soul of the people in great sorrow, reaching out to the best solution that they knew, and taking that solution and interpreting it according to their immediate, pressing, spiritual, moral, and ethical needs. As one of the writers of the period points out, it was the doctrine which for many people, for many sincere persons, kept dream and hope alive, made it possible to face a universe which seemed terrible, but which had to be understood. And through understanding, man again restored his faith in both God and his fellow man. Now, as we've also said, the Neoplatonic school flourished in three general areas: Athens, Rome, and Alexandria. And it also, to a certain degree, spread through the entire Mediterranean area and through a good part of the Aegean area. And in the course of its unfolding, it gives to us another interesting name in connection with the descent of philosophy, and that is Iamblichus. He was a Syrian, born in what we would term today the Holy Land. And he was early under the influence of Porphyry, Plotinus, and other members of the Neoplatonic school. We do not know the exact date of the death of the birth of Iamblichus, but he died A.D. 330. Thus he belongs in the latter part of the 3rd and the first part of the 4th century. He preceded Proclus, who mentions him in his own writings, and follows after the great masters of the first Neoplatonic revival. Of Iamblichus himself, we have very little information. Probably the most that we can ever know of a person of this kind is to be derived from the tone and quality of his work. As a person, he is indistinct. As a character, as a temperament, as an individual, he is rather powerfully delineated. Iamblichus was by no means the most brilliant of the Neoplatonists. That he was a serious and sober scholar, we know. That he was a man of great personal piety, we can also rather quickly apperceive from his work. In his life and in his thinking, devotion dominated. And while, as was natural in those days, in which there was no essential division between religion and philosophy, there is not a clear line of demarcation in his thinking. We can see that everything he touched, he handled with a peculiar and wonderful mystical reverence. He was never satisfied merely to approach things on an intellectual level. He had to go beyond this. Therefore, his name is particularly associated with one step or degree of the Neoplatonic ladder of development. I explained that ladder in general to you last week, rising from opinion through all the different degrees of intellect, and finally culminating or terminating at the upper end in theurgy. Iamblichus was one of the principal exponents of this mystery of theurgy, which has been likened by some Westerners to Grecian yoga. But this is not actually a proper definition. It indicates a lack of a critical consideration. Because actually, while both of these disciplines seek a certain kind of spiritual exaltation, the concept of yoga and of the Neoplatonic theurgy, these concepts are essentially different. Of course, there is one point that I think that we have to recognize in both schools, however, and that is that when we use the term, either in India or in Greece, of spiritual exaltation or the elevation of a spiritual condition, it is not to be interpreted in the sense or a meaning, in any sense of the word, personal aggrandizement. Because to them, all elevation, both in the East and West, was departure from personality toward universality. Therefore, no individual who attained to a high state could possibly establish the concept of personal possession of wisdom or knowledge. The entire concept, both of yoga and theurgy, is that the more the individual ascends, the more completely he recognizes the identity of life, the identity of the human need, and his own exceedingly humble place as a servant of common good. Therefore, ascent does not mean vainglory or self-aggrandizement. Ascent means the actual attainment of a level of internal realization in which the self is no longer important. This is clearly pointed out in no uncertain words by the Neoplatonists, and also is to be found in practically every ancient Oriental work dealing with the yogic or Vedantic disciplines. Now, theurgy becomes so important to Iamblichus that he devoted a very great part of his writing to this consideration. He had a school which was reasonably strong but did not survive very long because all of Neoplatonism was gradually entering into a period of fierce persecution from which it did not survive as a sect. Although it did survive in many respects to dominate practically every system of idealistic thinking from its own time to Ralph Waldo Emerson. In the Neoplatonic group founded by Iamblichus were a number of fairly brilliant scholars, and there is still some question today as to which one of these, or if all of them together, united to produce the text which we are interested in this evening. Its ancient title, as it first appears in known manuscripts and in the first incunabular printings, is Iamblichus on the Mysteries of the Egyptians. Now this term would imply, apparently, that the work was by Iamblichus. Here again, however, there seems to be a certain amount of historical doubt. Whether it was his own work or whether it was compiled like the so-called Golden Verses of Pythagoras, we do not know. But certainly we do know from his other writings that it represents him, that it represents the attitudes, opinions, and beliefs which he held. And as it takes form and develops before us, it becomes impersonalized almost on the title page of it. Here is the first edition of the work in English from the translation of Mr. Thomas Taylor, probably one of the outstanding commentators and translators of Greek and classical thought of his time. And in this we find a great deal of interesting information at the beginning of the work. We find, for example, that the book is held to be the result of a correspondence between a Greek philosopher and an Egyptian scholar. And therefore, we have the following description below the title. The answer of the preceptor, Abamon, to the epistle of Porphyry to Anibo, resolving certain doubts. And these doubts evidently relate, as the work unfolds, to the technique or theory of theurgy, or the mystery of the union of human consciousness with the divine. The entire work, then, is related directly or indirectly to the Egyptian system as it was after the collapse of the Greco-Egyptian religious culture, and after Egypt had become a vassal state of the Roman Empire. So we must pause for just a moment here to introduce another interesting motion which is discernible at this time. Somewhere, perhaps as early as the 1st century, certainly not later than the 4th or 5th A.D., there arose in Egypt a school which is called the Hermetic. Now, the Hermetists claimed, of course, a great antiquity to their doctrine and belief. But no text or no works dealing with the Hermetic mystery, no work is known prior to the early centuries of the Christian era. Like many other mysterious organizations, it seems to have assumed an antiquity or to have been based upon older records, beliefs, or traditions, but as a formal group seems to have risen about the same time as the Gnostics, the Kabbalists in the Syrian area, the Neoplatonists, and the Essenes and other mystical sects. The Hermetists represent, therefore, a last statement, and to a degree a purification or attempt to regenerate and redeem the great gradually vanishing system of Egyptian religion. Now we know, for example, that the Egyptian religion flourished almost undiminished in grandeur and glory for nearly 5,000 years. And from the earliest texts that we have, many of which go back 4,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era, the system was already highly evolved and highly instituted. We must also realize that in the early periods of Egyptian religion, the faith was an extremely democratic system. In other words, there was no such a thing as a formal religion of Egypt. We have to use a term, Egyptian religion, but it actually carries a consideration of probably 30 or 40 different faiths united into a grand pattern. But these faiths, each with an individual and distinct structure. The great common denominator of these faiths was in the person of the Pharaoh, who as priest-king presided over all the nomes or provinces of Egypt and was, to a measure, the hierophant of all their mysteries. But with this general overshadowing concept, the religions of the provinces and states of Egypt were very largely local. And during the comparatively early period of this development, deities began to take shape in the nomes or provinces. At one time, for example, Amun-Re, who later became the supreme solar deity of Egypt, was merely the god of a very small province. The rise of the Osirian cult was comparatively late in Egyptian religion. And in its early development, Osiris was also a local community deity, not known outside of a very restricted area. The same was true of the mysterious deity Thoth. Thoth, the god of the writing table, seems to have been partly derived from the earlier Assyrian, Chaldean, and Babylonian concept, which was summarized in the deity Nebo. Nebo, there is a statue of him in the British Museum. On the base of the statue are these words: "What has been, will be. I am Nebo, Lord of the Writing Table." Nebo was the keeper of the records. He was the wise historian, chronicler, scribe of the gods. He was also an intellectual deity, ruling mind and thought. And he was the one who recorded all of the wisdom and wonder of the universe. Gradually, in the rise of the Assyrian-Chaldean complex, therefore, Nebo became identified with the principle of mind, because he was the mind of the gods. He was their messenger. He was their friend. But he also took upon himself various attributes, and as the divine mind, he descended to earth, took form, and taught men. Therefore, he brought the wisdom of the gods to men, and gained a great distinction as the messenger or manifestor of the divine will. He was the beloved son of the Father God, and was therefore an intercessor between gods and men. We find this in the ancient cuneiform tables in the British Museum and in other ancient monuments and repositories. Nebo, in some of his attributes, gradually moved toward one of the lesser nomes or provinces of Egypt on the Chaldean side of the country, and by degrees insinuated himself through his worship into many other areas. And so gradually, by the time of the Great Recension, which resulted in the rise of a more or less codified Egyptian religion, he emerged in the full glory of Thoth, the ibis head, or the deity who was the scribe and the recorder of the gods, represented with the stylus and the waxen tablet. Thoth was therefore, in turn, identified with the principle of wisdom. And as wisdom, and as the scribe of the gods, as their messenger, as the ambassador of the deities to various parts of the world, he gradually came to the notice of the Greeks, who found him exceedingly similar to one of their own divinities. When the Greek hierarchy of pharaohs took over in Egypt under the Ptolemies, and under the splendid court of Ptolemy Philadelphus, the Greco-Egyptian complex of religion began to emerge and take particular form. And in this period, there rose several deities that had previously been comparatively local. But because of their similarities or parallels with Greek gods, became more and more intriguing and interesting to the Greek hierarchy and the Greek principalities that arose in Egypt. These deities were, in more or less in order of importance, Thoth, Osiris, Isis, and Serapis. All of these deities show a very strong later Grecian influence. Of course, all of them were worshipped earlier, but usually not in the same way, or with the same legends, or with the same interpretation. The nearest to being an exception to this would be Isis, who was worshipped in much larger areas at an earlier date. But the great Osirian Isis and the cycle of legends which surrounded her in connection with Hermes and Serapis were of comparatively late date. But she flourished greatly in the last years, the last centuries of the Egyptian religion. In the transition from Greece to Egypt of certain philosophical doctrines, possibly post-Pythagorean, there is the transition between Thoth and Thoth Hermes. And little by little, the Egyptian Thoth came to be known even in Egypt as Hermes. As Hermes, he was still essentially the scribe in the Book of the Dead. He was still the messenger and writer of the gods. He was still the mediator between the gods and mankind. But by the time we come to the cycle covered by our story this evening of Iamblichus and his work on the mysteries, Hermes had come forward and had eclipsed Isis and Osiris and Serapis. Hermes had become the principal patron of the late Egyptian restoration. And gradually from this circumstance, there rose a new sect, which is called the Hermetists. Now, many persons think that the Hermetic philosophers were essentially alchemists. In the chemical sense of the term, this is not so. The original Hermetic teachings were very much closer to the Gnostic and the Essene. And the divine Pyrmander, the shepherd of men, and the great dialogues and discourses of Hermes constitute a literature highly mystical, with a considerable amount of Gnostic and Neoplatonic influence, and also with borrowings, obviously, from the Kabbalah, and quite possibly from the Far East, because your caravan routes were functioning at that time. The Hermetic mysteries, as we recognize them at this point, therefore, were highly philosophical, highly metaphysical. They related primarily to the regeneration of man, and approached the subject very much on the same level as the Neoplatonists. The Neoplatonists mingled considerably with the Hermetic philosophers, and it is interesting to note that in the rise of the Christian Church, which followed within two or three centuries of this date, that the only early pagans or neo-pagans that have been held in high esteem by the Church and were never publicly attacked or defamed by the Church, but were regarded as legitimate predecessors of the church philosophy were Plato, Hermes, and the small original group of Neoplatonists. These individuals were given particular consideration, perhaps because St. Augustine of Hippo, who was one of the first codifiers of Roman law under the Holy Roman Empire, was himself strongly addicted to these sects. In any event, the Hermetic teachings drifted into the early works of the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers, and there is very little conflict. In fact, these and the Platonic works were accepted almost without question and contributed very largely to the modification and structure of the early church. This is not speculation. The anti-Nicene fathers themselves explicitly state that this is so. And writing in the first and second centuries, they should be in a reasonable position to know. This particular point, then, brings us now to the involvement of Hermes in this particular work. It begins with a sentence relating to Hermes in which the preceptor, Abamon, the Egyptian, explains that the wisdom which is herein contained, and obviously following the Hermetic story almost exactly, may be traced or was traceable to Hermes, the god who presided over language, and was formerly very properly considered as common to all the priests. He explains, for example, that the wisdom which he is going to unfold in this study of the mysteries is based upon the Hermetic pillars, which were probably buried or hidden under the temple of Thais in Egypt, where Solon claimed to have seen them as a result of a trip through a subterranean lake to an island under the earth, where the two pillars of Hermes, or as they are also alternately called by the non-Hermetist group, the pillars of Enoch, were said to have been standing since antediluvian times. Our priest in this particular work says that these pillars have been seen and studied by Pythagoras when he was in Egypt, and that this knowledge, which was upon these pillars, was known to both Pythagoras and Plato, and that it was through them that it descended into the Greek side of Neoplatonism, and it was through the Egyptian branch or side of the subject that it descended through the Hermetic mysteries. And that therefore, in a sense, the two works had a great kinship with each other. The general tone of this book reminds us of the opinion that was presented by Solon after his return from Egypt. Solon, who was one of the first great lawgivers of Greece, and the man who reformed the great problem of boundaries and ownerships and land, and was the first to make impossible the enslavery of man in Greece for debt. He was a great liberal and a great leader. Solon, returning from Egypt after he had sought among the Egyptians the information necessary to reform the Athenian law, Solon observed an incident that had occurred to him while he was in Egypt. He had been asking questions of one of the Egyptian priests, and suddenly the priest turned to him and shook his head very, very sadly, said, "Oh, you Greeks, oh, you Greeks, why will you forever remain children?" In other words, perhaps it was a little bit of sophistry on the part of the Egyptians. We don't know. Of course, every ancient nation believed its own culture was the best. But the Egyptians always regarded the Greeks as sort of perpetual adolescents. They were never willing to acknowledge that the Greeks quite equaled them in penetration into the great mysteries of life. And in this particular work, Iamblichus, if he is following an original document, as is indicated, certainly picks up this particular problem. Because in the letter which is being answered by the priest was written by one of the Greek philosophers, and the priest, in answering it, nearly in every question and section, corrects the Greek. In other words, he does not agree with the Greek approach to the entire subject. Now, one of the interesting things about the section which is here, which deals with the subject of theurgy, is the principle involved. The book itself carries through on the subject of divination. In other words, the work deals theoretically and practically with the possibility of man receiving from the gods or from superior beings answers to mysteries, guidance, instruction, and whether it is possible for man with the aid of gods, or of powers, or of mysteries, or of secrets, to foretell the future, to know that which is to come, but most of all, to advance to the state of theurgy, which in this work is said to be able to foretell the everlastingness. In other words, to foretell, as the priest explains, not what will happen, but what you will be when it happens. And the Egyptian points out that this is the most important mystery, because anything that will ever happen in the future to you can only happen because of what you are. Therefore, to merely project the future upon the basis of our present state is to prophesy uncertainly, because we are not able to know even what we may desire at a remote time. So a man saying, will I fulfill my desire at a certain future time? And the oracle says yes. The man knows not what his future desire will be. Therefore, he cannot tell in what detail or particular fulfillment will be attained. The individual, by virtue of the fact that he is forever growing, his destiny and his fate is not due, as the Greek and Egyptian priest says, to the mutations of the world, but rather to the state of the individual in the world. Because if he changes, 10,000 may fall upon the right hand and 10,000 upon the left hand, but the just man shall not be moved. Therefore, the degree of his own justice determines his own survival. And it is on this grounds that the theurgic priest, the Egyptian, says that the great mystery of prophecy or of divination is to divine our own core of consciousness at any time but this moment, because this core is forever changing. Therefore, our likes and dislikes are forever changing. And these problems concern a considerable part of this work. The work also explains the Neoplatonic concept of theurgy as a kind of divination by which man is able to invoke the knowledge of the mystery of truth, as Isis, by her conjuration, invoked the power of Re and took from him the secret word of divine authority. In order also to understand the work, I want to read just one or two paragraphs to give you, who may not read the book, something of the spirit of it. Because, as has been noted in the case of Iamblichus, there are tremendous overtones in the spirit of the man himself. This spirit also shines through the entire concept of Neoplatonism. And therefore, from the introduction of the book itself, I'd like to call attention not particularly to Iamblichus, but to the strange, wonderful, mystical, and yet profoundly significant way in which these statements were made. They are quite different from nearly all other philosophical or sacred literature. They are almost unique. Now, this is the definition in Neoplatonism of creation. And I'm just going to read about a paragraph to give you some concept of their idea and of the strangely subtle way in which they expressed it. According to this theology, therefore, from the immense principle of principles, in which all things causally subsist and exist, absorbed in superessential light and involved in unfathomable depths, a beauteous progeny of principles proceed, all largely partaking of the ineffable, all stamped with the occult characters of deity, all possessing an overflowing fullness of good. From these dazzling summits, these ineffable blossoms, these divine propagations, being, life, intellect, soul, nature, and body depend. Monads suspended from unities, deified natures proceeding from deities. Each of these monads, too, is the leader of a series which extends from itself to the last of things, and which, while it proceeds from, at the same time abides in and returns to its leader. And all these principles and all their progeny are finally centered and rooted by their summits in the first great all-comprehending one. Thus all beings proceed from and are comprehended in the first being. All intellects emanate from the one first intellect. All souls from the one first soul. All natures blossom from one first nature, and all bodies proceed from the vital and luminous body of the world. And lastly, all these great monads are comprehended in the first one, from which they and all their depending series are unfolded into light. Hence this first one is truly the unity of unities, the monad of monads, the principle of principles, the God of gods, one and all things, yet one which is prior to all. I think that is probably the most complete summary of the doctrine that we can find in the Neoplatonic literature. It also gives us something now of the spirit of this particular doctrine. Iamblichus claims very definitely that a great part of this material is derived from the remnants and the fragments and the surviving instruments of the old Pythagorean system. And he points out very definitely in this concept what he calls the concept of unity, which more or less unfolded in this definition. These unities as unfolding or descending blossoms suspended from unity. Iamblichus explains through the Egyptian priest, or perhaps it is the priest himself explaining, we probably will never know, that all things proceeding from unity must forever bear within themselves the seed of unity. That unity itself stamps with what Verney calls the signatura rerum, the great seal of likeness. And that nothing can proceed from unity that is not itself a unity. Therefore, according to this system, all beings proceeding from primordial beings partake inwardly and eternally of unity, and likewise subsist in and forever remain within the body of all circumscribing essential unity. Also, Iamblichus tells us that the most proper and least erroneous definition of the unity of unities, the principle of principles, is that it is the one and the good. It is the one because by unity, man bestows the supreme sense of his own power to bestow honor. As his own consciousness and his own nature instinctively perceives the oneness to be the most honorable, to be the most ancient, to be the most inevitable. And by oneness or unity, he bestows the attribute or title of totality. Therefore, totality as one is the supreme being. The Egyptian then says that the term the good is peculiarly appropriate also, inasmuch as it is the inevitable and natural instinct of all creatures to desire the good, to seek the good. And gradually, through the unfolding faculties and powers which they gradually come to possess, to serve the good, to demand or require the life of virtue, and to honor the gods by the performance of that which is good. Therefore, by the one is expressed the nature and root of being, and by the good, the eternal, everlasting, never-ceasing yearning of all life for the experience of that which is its own ultimate, the eternal subsistence within the substance of the good. that all things that may be good. That man may be in himself good, and through his own goodness make good the world. And that when he achieves these ends, he is at the same time stating his highest religious conviction concerning the One, because he instinctively assumes that the great desire of the One, as expressed through creation, is for the realization, manifestation, and total fullness of the good. Therefore, the One moving into activity in any form moves by virtue, and that all the works of the One are good, and all the creations of the One are in themselves good, and that therefore the gradual revelation of good is the final revealing of the One in all the states of human society. This also brings us to another point, which I would like to also read, and this will be the only reading we'll do. But I want to bring this example out because it points up another situation that I mentioned, namely that the Egyptians were a little inclined to regard the Greeks as inadequate in their philosophical approach to things. Now, in a book of this kind, it is quite possible that the author intentionally enters a mistaken concept in order to sustain the explanation. In other words, he may cause the student in the writing to make a comparatively foolish question in order that the scholar, the wise man, the sage, may have an opportunity to unfold the correct answer. It's a method in dialogue which is frequently used in classical writings, because if the question is always complete and perfect, there is usually no need for the answer. A completely perfect question is the complete answer of itself. Therefore, there has to be something wrong in the statement, or it does not lead to a discourse or dialogue. So in the dialectical and dialogic form, this is common. Now, in the Egyptian priest answering the Greek, we have an interesting point here, which also sustains one of the abstractions of this point. In the first place, therefore, you say, the Egyptian is now answering the questions, of Porphyry. You say, it must be granted that there are gods. This is the statement which the Greek makes. The Egyptian answers this way. Thus to speak, however, is not right on this subject. For an innate knowledge of the gods is coexistent with our very essence. And this knowledge is superior to all judgment and deliberate choice, and subsists prior to reason and demonstration. It is also co-united from the beginning with its proper cause, and is consubsistent with the essential tendency of the soul to the good. If indeed it be requisite to speak the truth, the contact with divinity is not knowledge. For knowledge is in a certain respect separated from its object by a state of otherness. This is a very subtle point. But prior to the knowledge, which as one thing knows another thing, is the uniform connection with divinity, and which is suspended from the gods, is spontaneous and inseparable from them. Hence it is not proper to grant this, as it might not be granted, nor to admit it as ambiguous, for it is always uniquely established in energy, nor are we worthy to explore it, as if we had sufficient authority to approve or reject it. For we are comprehended in it, or rather we are filled by it, and we possess that very thing which we are, or by which our essence is characterized, in the knowing of the gods. Therefore, he tells us in this, which is a part of his introduction to theurgy, that the theurgical art is the transcendence by the individual or by the truth seeker of that knowledge by which he affirms or rejects any matters relating to the divine. In other words, I don't mean that he conforms necessarily to an opinion, but rather that he does not approach the nature of the eternal or being, as Iamblichus calls it, as something worthy of contemplation, or something which can be contemplated by another thing separate from itself. The Egyptian here is pointing out that in this subject, therefore, man depends upon the use of a power within himself, which is not his own power, but the power of unity or divine cause, eternally subsistent within his own nature. Therefore, that man can only apperceive the true nature of being by virtue of the quality or power of that being in him, and not by any power or nature, attribute, or faculty of his own. This is the foundation of theurgy, as it is taught in Neoplatonism, that the individual can never produce a vehicle of consciousness by which he is capable of transcending the limitations of this otherness, which is the state of his own approach to, estimation of, or reflection upon reality or truth as something separate or distinct. He is therefore warned in the beginning of the theurgical arts, which were the highest levels of the Neoplatonic mystery, that to contemplate is to proceed to the point in which we may see things as pictures, or as likenesses, or as representations. And that these likenesses and representations, like great art, great music, or any other magnificent aesthetic expression, may stimulate us, may enthrall us, may give great joy and beauty to us, may ennoble us, and may give us the strength and security for further achievement. But in themselves, they cannot be considered as the direct manifestations of the supreme power. Inasmuch as that which can be contemplated apart from man implies the existence within the experience of man of a state of disunity, man and the object of his quest are two, and truth is one. Therefore, the Neoplatonists maintain that as long as the observer observes, as long as the knower knows, as long as the thinker thinks, there must be otherness. And therefore, that the supreme work, which they believe to have been the original doctrine or concept of the Greek mystery, was that man must first overcome otherness. Or, as they would have said it, perhaps more wisely, that this overcoming of otherness is not the first, but the last. It is the most difficult and the most abstract and mysterious of the theurgical practices. This, of course, consummated or crowned the entire Neoplatonic system, and all of their other disciplines, as Porphyry and Plotinus also tell us, that all of the disciplines were to prepare the individual to approach the mysterious state of non-otherness. Here, of course, we have had reason to liken certain of these concepts to the Eastern systems, to Buddhism with its Nirvana, to the Vedanta or Yoga with their Samadhi and other similar states. But in the Neoplatonic system, it is a little bit different. The Neoplatonists did not seek identification with eternity through the rejection of life. He did not seek to destroy the individual. He did not seek to prevent the natural growth of the intellect or the unfoldment of any attribute which man may have inherited from what our Egyptian would call the secondary gods. Other than that, the Neoplatonists made great stress and emphasis upon the individual achieving what they would term the philosophic life through the gradual, sequential transcendence of limitation. In other words, the great initiation rite was growth itself. And growth represented the individual's achieving and transcending, never evading or avoiding or seeking to escape. That there was no way through any problem in the long course of human experience except straight through. That the individual had to always have victory. For failing in victory, he failed in release. Any problem that is not completely solved must remain a terrible uncertainty in the consciousness of the individual. And he will therefore face it again and again. Not because the problem necessarily is so great, but because his own strength is not great enough. Thus, in the Neoplatonic system, man grew by exhausting the limitations imposed by every level of existence. This is precisely the burden of the divine Pymander or the Shepherd of Hermes, in which the individual, the initiate seeking the mysteries, ascends through the orbits of the seven planets, and at each of these orbits, he transcends or solves the mystery of that orbit. And so finally, he attains to the empyrean and passes through the mysterious little door in heaven and comes before the throne of the Great One above the great crystalline sea, as described in the book of Revelation. A very large part of that magnificent scene in Revelation is almost word for word from the Hermetic books. In the Neoplatonic concept, therefore, we have the gradual experience of the individual moving from the sense of separateness or the sense of aloneness toward the sense of identity. To the Egyptian who writes this book, aloneness is the acknowledgement of the acceptance of diversity. The more completely the individual believes in many, the more completely he is capable of isolation. If he believes in 10 or 100 or 1,000, he is one of them. And they may all exist around him, and they may all press in upon him. Therefore, aloneness is the statement of the acceptance of the even or divided number, the representation of the individual's inability to recognize unity. And the Egyptian also points out that from the earliest points of man's existence, he has been moving from a savage isolation toward a gradual integration of a social structure in which he no longer experiences aloneness. Thus, in the archetype or in the divine pattern, even as the gods in their own motions move again towards the victory of re-identification, so man in his great migration through life is forever moving away from separateness and towards the increasing recognition of wholenesses. Iamblichus tells us that these unities, which represent the roots or seeds which flow from or descend from primordial unity, that these unities are innumerable. And that man conquering diversity always does so by the discovery or the experience of some kind of unity. And he also, and later Proclus points out to us, that every experience of a unity is an illumination. In other words, the moment the individual sees the bridges between separate things, he begins to have the theurgic vision to some degree. Because theurgy is not merely a consummation in itself. It is a gradually unfolding, growing power of apperception by which certain things, not now obvious, become more and more continuously apparent to the consciousness. Therefore, a unity or the experience of the discovery of monads or entities may exist on any level. One of the old philosophers pointed out the fact that when a man takes a piece of wood, puts three legs under it, and makes a stool, that this individual has made a unity out of diversity. He has built a unity, and that all building is the bringing of things together, even as all destruction is the separation of things. Now, actually, the Neoplatonists did not believe in a principle of destruction. They believe that disintegration always occurs, that reintegration may follow on a higher level. But they did recognize that things may fall apart. And they also considered that things which fall apart pass from a state of growth into a state of decay. So that something that becomes decadent, that falls apart, that relaxes, that no longer hangs together, that no longer has integration and purpose, this inevitably leads to decay and the final disintegration of parts. So that unity may be experienced in many levels of unity. For example, in art, we may have a unity of a small group of artists with a single purpose, perhaps a half dozen of them, come together for some particular project, thus forming an entity or an entirety. And following, as he expresses it, one of the older doctrines of Pythagoras, Iamblichus points out that the moment a group of divided elements are restored to a unity, they are ensouled by a power. And that this ensouling power is derived from the numerical archetype of the universe. And that every number that is conceivable to man consists of two things, a monadal number, or a numeration, and an ordinary number, or the sequences that we know. Therefore, for instance, the number 60 is either a unit, 60, or else it is 61, the infinite diversity of its own number. In the grouping, as he explains it, therefore, the experience of unification releases archetype which exists in space. For every numeration or compound composed of the potential of numbers abides also in its own state as a unity.